Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And our contributor, Leila Latif.
Hello.
Hello, you two. This week we'll be weighing up Kenneth Branagh's autobiographical Belfast, Guillermo del Toro's potboiler Nightmare Alley, Michael B. Jordan's Weepy, Journal for Jordan, and World War II drama Munich, The Edge of War. But before we get stuck into those, we should be talking about what we're all doing tomorrow. What are we starting tomorrow, guys?
Sundance. Sundance 2022 starts Sundance. Tomorrow. Very exciting.
Yeah.
All virtual again this year,
yes.
Of course.
Yes. Because... So we all had dreams of stomping around in the snow, didn't we?
I know.
Being really, really cold, but enjoying hot chocolates in the sort of HQ and dodging icicles from overhanging buildings and all of that fun that goes into Sundance, losing your boot in a snowdrift, which happened to me one year, you know, waiting for buses in the driving snow and never being as cold in your entire life as you have been in Park City. But they changed it to virtual this year. But what can we expect this year, Jordan? What's on the list that you're excited about?
Yeah, it's another typically strong lineup. Top of my list is Duel, which is Riley Stern's latest film. It stars Karen Gillan. It has a near identical setup to the Mahershala Ali film Swan Song. Mm. So it's about a woman who gets a terminal illness, and instead of, you know, choosing just to die gracefully, she chooses to clone herself so her family don't have to suffer when she dies. But instead of, you know, if you saw Swan Song, you'll know that was kind of a, I guess, a meditative exploration of loss and letting go. But in this film, the clones have to fight to the death to decide who will get to stick around when, you know, Karen Gillan's character recovers from her terminal illness. So that sounds very fun. I'm really looking forward to that because I loved Riley Stern's last film, The Art of Self-Defense, with Jesse Eisenberg. So I'm expecting very good things from that one.
What about you, Leila? What's on your list?
Yeah, I've only just kind of gotten this on my radar, but there's a film called Master that I think sounds really interesting. It's starring Regina Hall, and I'm not normally that bothered about, you know, when they give you the list of the producers and they've produced previous things, because you think, well, you know, like producers aren't the be-all and end-all, and this is a directorial debut. But the producers are the guys behind It Follows, Never Rarely, Sometimes Always, and It Comes at Night, and those are like some of my favorite films of the past decade. And it's Regina Hall at a kind of prestige university, and they're not giving much away at all about what it's going to be. But that's probably why only just came on my radar. The picture that they've released is quite bland and stuff. But I think they seem to be putting a lot behind this, and like it's an intriguing premise. So I've kind of got high hopes that that's going to be great.
Tell me what your other thing is.
I say I'm quite intrigued by the one about the girl from Finland who's 12, who kind of nurses a giant monstrous egg.
Hatchling, yes. Just finds a giant egg and nurses it. Yes, that does look very interesting as well. There's also the Evan Rachel Wood documentary, Phoenix Rising, that's causing a bit of a stir because she's going to talk about her life with Marilyn Manson. But for my money, I love Dakota Johnson. And yes, I can forgive her for the 50 Shades of Grey. And she's in two films at the festival. She's in Cha-Cha Real Smooth, where she plays a sort of mother of an autistic daughter who has a sort of possibly weird romance, or maybe not a romance, we don't really know, with a university student. She's also in a film called Am I Okay, where it talks about sort of girls and friendships and how those friendships are tested, which I'm also looking forward to. Also, I mean, I can't not mention The Janes. There's the Janes documentary about a group of women who in the 70s helped women in Chicago facilitate abortions and female healthcare. And then there's also a narrative film that's been made with a great cast. So I'm obviously going to be watching the Jane films. Is there a Layla film? Is there a Jordan film? We're lucky this week, Jordan.
Yeah.
We've got a journal for Jordan to talk about this week. Have you got a journal to hand that you have written your notes about journal to Jordan in?
Sadly not. I was thinking I should, yeah, write my review in that journal, but
yes,
I never got around to buying one, unfortunately.
Well, more than
neither does he. It gets bought for him.
There you go.
Exactly.
He's passive journalist or journaler.
Yeah.
More on that later. Shall we get cracking with our first film of this week then? Let's go back in time and across the water to Ireland with this.
We're looking to cleanse the community, we've got.
You wouldn't want to be the old man out in the street.
Touch my family and I'll kill you.
Are we going to have to leave Belfast?
We'll fight this together.
This is it.
This is what?
This is war. Open up your
So this is Belfast. This is Kenneth Branagh's sort of version of Roma, I guess you would say. Tell us about it, Jordan.
Yeah, it's essentially his cine memoir. It's his most personal project to date, I think it's fair to say. It's a semi-autobiographical account of his own childhood growing up in Belfast during the Troubles in the late sort of 1960s. It stars Jude Hill as the Kenneth Branagh stand-in, although he's called Buddy, not Ken. He's 9 years old. He is the son of Ma, played by Katrina Balfe, and Pa, played by Jamie Dornan. The film actually opens after a sort of loving montage of Belfast by depicting a Protestant riot, which takes place on Buddy Street, literally outside his front door, where the homes of Catholic families were vandalized. So right from the outset, it sort of breaks this depiction of a postcard perfect rose-tinted view of Belfast, because the sort of danger of violence is ever present in Buddy's world. That said, for the most part, this film is very much a sort of gentle, affectionate love letter to a city and a people. Branagh, you know, clearly has a great deal of affection for Belfast and the time he spent there. There are slightly sentimental scenes of, you know, people standing in their front doors, sipping cups of tea as children sort of gleefully play football on the street. It's told from Buddy's perspective entirely, who is this cinema-obsessed young boy. So there's scenes of them, you know, going to the cinema to see Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, and this totally blowing his mind. So key sequences in the film have this almost heightened cinematic quality to them. There's this confrontation scene, I'll say, later in the film, which is staged almost like a Western. And there are scenes set at Buddy's school which are all about him sort of pining over this girl in class, which you have the feeling of something like Gregory's Girl or one of those classic sort of school romances. Apart from the sort of colour montages that open and close the film, it's shot entirely in black and white. And I did think that, you know, the cinematography was terrific in this. It gives it almost like a fable-like quality, like you're looking at an old photograph or something the whole time. I'll also add that Judi Dench and Kieran Hines are in this as Buddy's grandparents. They're a lot of fun. They add a load of value. And Katrina Balfe is particularly great, I thought, as Buddy's mum, who, you know, has to parent these two kids. Buddy has a brother who isn't a particularly big part of the film, but he is there, who has to, yeah, she has to parent these sometimes unruly young boys during a time of real intense stress. And I thought she was a particular standout for me, even though Jamie Dornan is the one who's grabbing all the headlines because he has a great sort of karaoke moment towards the end of the film where he sings Everlasting Love.
Yeah, I mean, who doesn't love that? I mean, we've all seen Barb and Star. We know he can knock out a tune and make sort of fun of himself. But there is discussion at the moment about Katrina being an Oscar hopeful with this film and that she's the one that's probably going to get awards. Do you think that's possible, Layla?
Yeah, I think she's certainly solid. I mean, the person that probably stood out the most to me was Kieran Hines as the grandfather. He's kind of got, I think he slightly reminded me of my grandfather, that kind of like slightly talks to you like you're a lot older than you actually are and isn't really that bothered about things being appropriate for children and has that kind of dark, twinkly sense of humour. But yeah, I got to say, this didn't do that much for me. And I really was expecting it would, because I have a grandmother who is a Protestant from Belfast who moved to England around this time. And I was really interested in seeing it. And I think the thing that kept happening to me is I just felt that it was quite bland. And when you kind of put it next to something like Roma, or I was thinking of like Steve McQueen's film Education, or even like Licorice Pizza with like Paul Thomas Anderson, you know, when people are making films about like their childhood or their family, something that was like really meaningful for them, you get these like really weird little details and perspectives and stuff. And I felt this kind of felt a bit like this was just kind of the most typical Belfast, and everybody was kind of playing more of an archetype than like a really like specific little character and stuff. So yeah, it didn't do, I mean, I didn't dislike it, but I couldn't see all of the fuss. And I got to say, I didn't really enjoy that Jamie Dornan performance of Everlasting Love, but the editing of that was very strange. Like, I felt like it was kind of it kind of cuts off halfway through just as it's kind of getting going and stuff. This didn't feel like a labor of love to me. This felt like something that you'd kind of, you know, get commissioned to do and just knock out something that was like a bit of a crowd pleaser and everybody does absolutely fine. But yeah, I kind of was quite surprised that this is like some really like personal heartfelt project, because I don't think that came across.
But is that possibly Kenneth Branagh as a director? I find it quite interesting that I agree with both of you. Some of it I found really wonderful and some of it frustratingly lacking in sort of a personal touch. It feels sort of beautiful and gorgeous to look at, and as you say, the cinematography is lovely, but it didn't really tell me very much more about Kenneth Branagh, and I find him quite inscrutable anyway as a filmmaker. The fact that I didn't even kind of realize that he grew up in Belfast for that long, I knew he was Irish, but you know, he has no Irish accent now, and he's just very much a man that you give thought to because you know he's going to do well with that, and it's not going to be, you know, it's just, you are going to get a really, you know, well-rounded and what you need film out of it. You give him Poirot because he's just going to manage that cast, and I feel like this is very much a sort of film that I would expect him to make because it's just very well done and craftsmanlike and does what it says on the tin, but it doesn't do anything outside of that. And that's, I suppose, if you're going in looking for something that will tell you about Branagh and tell you how he ticks, you're not going to get that.
In Branagh's defense, I will say that this isn't meant to be a biography. This is meant to be a work of fiction, which is loosely inspired by his life. So I can understand why he hasn't put, you know, every personal detail of his childhood in there. The thing that I really liked about it is that, you know, his love for this place and these people just really comes across in this film. It doesn't have the hard edges you might expect for something which is emerging as something of a sort of awards front runner. I know a lot of lists are actually putting this ahead of things like Power of the Dog as potential Best Picture winner.
Yes.
Which I'm a little surprised by, because I don't think it has the grit that will possibly stand the test of time, which, you know, in a few years, we'll probably just think of this as, you know,
it's like something a Green Book, isn't it? Loads of people will enjoy it. It's not going to really offend anyone. It's one of those sort of awards, sort of.
Exactly. It's, you know, it won the audience award at TIFF, which I can entirely see why it did that, because it's a real crowd pleaser. It's one of those films where I think if you watch it, I'd be very surprised if you didn't like this film, but I would also be quite surprised if you loved this film. It's just one of those films which sits in a nice middle ground where it just makes everyone happy without making everyone fall over themselves and absolutely sing its praises to the heavens. Like, it's not that kind of film, but I enjoyed my time with it, and I'm glad that Branagh has had the opportunity to tell a story like this, because he is a little bit of a journeyman director at times, you know. His most recent film before this was Artemis Fowl, which was a sort of notorious disaster, and he's made some real sort of yeah, exactly.
Did it feel like a disaster on set?
Yes. And I have to say, I did come back from that set visit, didn't I, Jordan? I was like, that film is not going to work.
You've always got to hope for the best, but sometimes you just know, don't you?
Yeah, that one. And, you know, they had such high hopes for it because they had built Artemis's house as a proper house. It had everything apart from running water, but electricity, heating, everything, all the drawers were full of stuff. It was a completely 360 build, clearly with the intention that this would be the next Harry Potter. But no, you can tell that wasn't going to happen.
So I can understand why Branagh would want to retreat into something a bit more personal and meaningful to him after an experience like that, which, you know, I imagine he was doing mainly for the paycheck. I don't want to assume, but come on. I would love to see him do more films like this, films that mean something to him in the same way that, you know, you mentioned Roma at the start of this. There are definite parallels with that film, but I don't think this is anywhere near as good as Roma was. I don't think it's anywhere near as impactful. It's the kind of film that I would happily show to my parents or even my grandparents and know that they would enjoy it, but yeah, it's not something that I'm going to be talking about in years to come, I don't think.
But in a way, that might be in its favour, because it's more accessible than Roma. It doesn't ask as much from you, does it? It asks you to have a love of cinema, which if you're watching a film, you generally have anyway, and sort of revel in this, as you say, this sort of heightened idea of nostalgia of the late 60s, when people were, you know, dancing in the street and kids went out from dawn till dusk and there was no phones and nobody was on a tablet and you were just making fun with a stick and a wheel. That sort of nostalgia. It is though, isn't it? You know, oh,
I know. Much,
yeah.
And then a mob arrives and ruins everyone's fun, but then off they go. Yeah, I love that. I always love that in Stephen King's books where it's just like, it doesn't matter whether there's kind of a mob with the kind of fiery torches and violence or a killer clown on the loose. You kids just get out there and we'll see you when we see you.
Yeah, just come back before dark when your tea's ready. Yeah, so if you like that sort of thing, this is going to tap into that, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Speaking of like the mob and the violence, obviously the Troubles are a part of this, as I mentioned at the start. It's always kind of lurking in the background, and it's sort of personified in a character played by Colin Morgan, who I have to say I didn't find very threatening at any point. Like, no, I just thought,
it's a shame because he's great.
Yeah. And we last saw him and Jamie Dornan facing off in The Fall, of course.
I just thought if Colin Morgan just approached me in a dark alley, I just like wouldn't feel threatened in any way. I'd just be like, let's keep walking. Thought that was a slight bit of miscasting. They could have made the element of danger there a bit more present with a slightly more intimidating actor. But apart from that, I thought all the stuff with the riots was actually quite well done.
Those are literally fighting words. You are basically challenging Colin Morgan.
If you're listening, would you like to meet Jordan in a dark alley? Because he thinks he can take you.
I've met him. I've interviewed him. He's a lovely guy. Maybe that's why I didn't find him intimidated on screen. But he'll think of it as a compliment, I'm sure. I'm saying he's a lovely guy.
And Jamie Dornan, I'm really enjoying the fact that he's actually doing some decent work after the 50 Shades blip. You know, I think he's really great in this as well. And as you say, it's sort of the film is carried on his shoulders as well as Buddy's, and his mother is as a lesser sort of role. So she'd be a supporting actress nod probably. Can Jamie get nods from this?
Yeah, possibly. I mean, he's great in the film. I think the thing that will possibly work against him is that his character is actually absent for a lot of the film. You know, his father works in England, his job, so he has to travel for his job. So he's not present for quite long stretches of the film, which is where I think Ma sort of picks up the slack a bit. So I would say if either of them are going to get a nod, I think it might actually be Ma, Katrina Balfe. But Jamie Dornan is great. And yeah, he's, you know, he's enshrined in like meme history, like the meme hall of fame because of this Everlasting Love performance, or he will be soon. So that could work in his favor.
Yeah. More singing, I think, Jamie, that's the thing for you. Okay. So if you fancy a bit of nostalgia and love of cinema, Belfast is out in the movies at the pictures on Friday. Should we move on then? Do you fancy a trip to the carnival?
Now, brief as you can, what is your name?
Stanton Carlisle.
Are you a true medium?
Yes, I am.
Mr. Carlisle.
Doctor, how about that?
Please lie down.
Can you read minds?
Yes, I can, under the right circumstances.
Keep your answers brief.
What do I want?
To be found out, same as everybody else.
Are you in contact with the beyond?
Well, we've had our share of snake charmers in the past. We deal with them.
So this is Nightmare Alley. Is it a nightmare, Layla?
It's a beautiful nightmare, as they say. It's Guillermo del Toro's latest, which is based on a book called Nightmare Alley, which I believe came out in about like 1946, and then quickly afterwards was adapted into a classic film noir. This is actually a little bit closer to the book. I read it years ago, but this kind of preserves the incredibly dark ending that was in the book that the audiences in the 40s kind of weren't quite ready for. So it's Bradley Cooper as Stan Carlisle, who in the opening moments is kind of setting fire to like a little house in a Terrence Malick-y beautiful field, and you know, striking out with nothing but a suitcase and a radio, trying to make a new life. And he comes across a carnival which is run by Willem Dafoe, and he befriends and kind of gets into a weird Oedipal relationship with Xena and Pete, who are kind of mentalist fake psychic sort of people, and they teach him his skills. And then it's kind of a classic neo-noir tale of, you know, a rise and fall of a man with great hubris who slowly makes a lot of very, very bad decisions.
Yes, indeed. Did you like it?
I loved it. And the funny thing is, when I was watching it, I was like, this is pacing is driving me absolutely insane. Why are we taking so long to get this? I've heard Kate Blanchett is in this film and she's amazing. I've been watching for an hour. Where is she? And then actually, the longer that passed after it ended, the more I keep thinking about it and thinking about it. And the more I've kind of gone from like to like a proper love, because, you know, I think a lot about films that, is it possible to have a great film with a bad ending? And I think this is a good film with one of the most phenomenal endings I've seen in a really long time. And it lands so with such power for me. And obviously I can only allude to the ending. But yeah, no, it actually really worked. And I just, you know, it was amazingly gorgeous. And I just really like to see someone like Guillermo del Toro with just kind of no holds barred, crazy aesthetics and the most incredible slinky performance from Cate Blanchett. Yeah, really into it.
Yeah. Jordan, did it do it for you? And did Cate Blanchett's slinky performance do it? I mean, you could not imagine anyone else playing this sort of very sort of snaky psychiatrist than her, could you?
Yeah, she was 100% born to play that role. Really loved her. I really loved Bradley Cooper, actually. You know, I really liked him in A Star Is Born, but I haven't, you know, thought a great deal of him in the past. But I think this is, by some stretch, his best performance, actually. Again, we're not going to spoil it, but that ending that Layla's alluding to just entirely rests on his acting, like his sort of facial performance. It's quite the thing. Yeah, he's great. He has the necessary charisma and the necessary sense of menace to him to really pull off quite a tricky role. His character was originally being eyed by Leonardo DiCaprio a few years ago. Mm-hmm. So it's the kind of role you can imagine him playing. But I actually think Cooper does a better job than even Leo might have done with this. He's a real piece of work. I mean, the interesting thing for me about Nightmare Alley is the fact that, you know, this is Guillermo's first film, which isn't, you know, a dark fantasy fable. There aren't creatures in this at all. This is his first non sort of genre film in that sense, in the supernatural sense. But it does contain a few of the more sort of monstrous characters that he's sort of ever committed to screen, which I was sort of won over by quite quickly. Stan is this grifter. He's this opportunist. He's initially quite charming and you want him to succeed, but you just see the way that power just completely corrupts him and pushes him over the edge. I found that journey really, really satisfying. The thing that I wasn't so sure on is the sort of novelistic structure that the film has. As Layla mentioned, we don't meet Cate Blanchett's character until the best part of an hour in, because the film is very much divided into these two sections. The first half being the carnival section, where Stan is sort of learning his trade, his sort of mentalism act, and he's hanging around with Willem Dafoe, who puts on this thing called a geek show, which is deeply horrifying.
Awesome.
And Rooney Mara, who is a character who sort of straddles these two sections and becomes a kind of love interest for Stan. And then the second section is when Stan has become this all-powerful mentalist. He's putting on this act for high society types in a hotel, and he partners up with Cate Blanchett's character, Dr. Lilith, to sort of exploit the rich and powerful and milk them for all they're worth, basically. And I really, really loved the first half, but I wasn't super keen on the second half. I think as soon as it sort of switches gear, it slightly took the momentum out of the film for me, because I was into the first half sort of so much. It might be something that is less of an issue on a second watch, but on the first watch, because it is quite a long film, it just took me a really long time to kind of get into it again. And I feel I may be slightly in the minority saying that, having read a lot of the reviews and our own review, because it seems that people really dig the second half. But I thought Guillermo was totally at home telling the story set in a carnival. And the second half just felt like a slightly more traditional, just noir to me, you know, beautifully shot, beautiful Art Deco production design. But I sort of always knew where the second half was going. I thought,
but did you though?
I did with a lot of the characters. Yeah, come on. Like, it's very obvious what the motivations of Kate Blanchett's characters are right from the moment you meet her, and then it just follows that through.
But don't you feel like that is the point of that, is to wrong foot you so that you're over here looking at one thing, and it's basically misdirection, which is what is being used in most of the shows that are being put on for the rubes that are turning up for this carnival. It's misdirection. Look at this over here. Look at what's going on over here, whilst actually this is happening over here, and it's just going to pull the rug from under you. You're going to go home, find you don't have your dollars in your pocket, and you've eaten something disgusting. That's essentially the whole of this film, isn't it? I agree with both of you. Like, the pacing drove me mad, like glacial almost. Like, where is this going? But then, unlike you, Jordan, you know, having gone through that sort of Dumbo-esque sort of first half, also, you know, the Greatest Showman elements, Water for Elements in there, you know, we've seen this before. I actually liked the turn it took in the second half and where it went with the sort of the very strange scenario in a garden. Sailing really close to the wind, this sort of this Icarus level of really taking too much, and you and this idea of he can't get enough and that's going to be his downfall, and then the total turnaround by the end. And I was like, oh my God, I should have kept my eye on that. I didn't. Oh, and that, as you say, Layla, by the time that came around and I realized what had happened, I was like, I want to see this again now, knowing what's going to happen, so I'm not frustrated by the pacing, in order to watch it all again and watch that delicious unfolding and to see the signs that were there. So yeah, it really worked for me after the fact, which is a weird thing, isn't it?
Because it just all ties together so neatly, and things that were really like frustrating that they would allude to in the beginning, and you'd just be like, well, why are we spending so long on kind of the trauma of First World War and the spirals of addiction that it's created in the homeless community, you know, like all of those things. And I mean, I would say that there was a bit of a red herring where they keep returning to this baby in a jar. Mm. I kept thinking that was going to lead to something. But aside from that, it actually all just felt like so exquisitely constructed when you kind of took a step back from it, and everything tied together and so many things come full circle in like various ways.
Yeah.
Good stuff from Del Toro.
Yeah. And it sort of reminded me of Shutter Island in the denouement, but also in the journey and the realization of a character. So I could sort of see why Leonardo DiCaprio would be attached to this. But as you say, Jordan, I do think Bradley Cooper just brings that self-destructive element that we saw in A Star Is Born, probably not enough of, but also that avariciousness and the using of people. And isn't the using of people so apt for him? I don't want to say any more because I don't want to give anything away, but I just think it's so satisfying what happens to most people in this. And yeah, and let's talk about Kate Blanchett. I mean, wow, after Carol, and also there's the element of the wicked stepmother in Kenneth Branagh's Cinderella here. She's just magnificent in this, and her magnificent office. Where can I get a walnut sliding door that when people come to visit me, I can just slide it open and say hello whilst wearing a black suit that's perfectly tailored? Just saying, that's going to be my next sort of DIY project, I think, for my lounge.
And I just love that office. The kind of set design of so much of it was so immaculately realized that I found that, like, in certain scenes where they would be in her office, I would just be looking at kind of the finishings of the joinery
and that beautiful lamp.
Oh God, that lamp, which at times, she's just got an incredible way of moving in this role. Like, she almost seems like she's underwater because everything is so kind of like velvety through the air and so like slow and languid. It was a little bit like when you're playing tennis, that Bradley Cooper, when he was then with Kate Blanchett, he kind of ups his game as well. So I think that's actually, I think maybe with Rooney Mara, not so much. She's a bit bland.
But she hasn't got a great deal to work with, has she, in terms of characterization? She doesn't get to have a juicy ah-ha-ha moment. She is literally probably fodder, which, yes, it's disappointing for her, I think. Having obviously been the girl with the dragon tattoo, she is quite a bland character in this. But incredibly, like a clockwork, what she does is incredibly important to everything else that happens. And this is just like a beautiful skeleton clock that you can see all of the wheels moving by the time you get to the end. And she is a perfect cog in that. Okay, so I think we're highly recommending this one, aren't we?
Yeah, be patient. It all comes together.
Yeah, and yeah, do we think awardsy
I mean, probably it not. Might get some, yeah, craft awards, costumes, production, but I mean, just because it hasn't made enough of a splash, really, like critics love it, but feels like no one's gone to see it.
I know, and certainly it also suffered, didn't it, with the Spider-Man scenario in the States, that it came out and people were taking it off screens in order to put Spider-Man in more screens. So it did suffer a not great opening weekend in the States. Do you think in the UK we can reverse that and show our love of cinema by going to see it?
Yeah, I mean, UK audiences are more discerning audiences than the American audience. So
sweeping generalisation. Jordan also wants to fight with everyone in America as well.
Yeah, come to that alley. Leaving this with some enemies.
If you come here in the next hour, I'll beat you up.
Okay. Fighting talk. It's a very big alley. We've got more to go, so maybe there's more people he wants to fight. But for now, let's just say that Nightmare Alley is out in cinemas on Friday. Go and see it. So now it's time for Plain Talking, where we demystify things we hear on set, weirdness that they talk. And this one is number one. So it's when people say, I've got number one, number one's in the car. What does that mean, Jordan?
I'm assuming that this means it's the person at the top of the call sheet, you know, the first person. In the case of Nightmare Alley, it would be Bradley Cooper. He would be top of the call sheet because he's the main character. He's in most of the scenes. They would just be letting people know that, you know, the main actor is on their way and they should get ready.
Yeah. You hear it on, you know, number one out of makeup. And, you know, if you're number one on the call sheet, you know you are the big star of it. So that's the thing to aim for.
Just it was quite interesting that recently when Jennifer Lawrence was talking about Don't Look Up, she had a big thing about how she negotiated to be number one on the call sheet, because at first it was going to be her and Leo equal, and she decided, she kind of managed to get to be agreed that no, she would be number one, but then it transpired he was getting many millions of dollars more than her. So it's weird what matters to people.
That is very annoying, yeah, because being number one doesn't necessarily translate to dollars in the bank. So but fair play to her for getting number one over Leo. Good work.
I was going to say, I wonder how they deal with number one on the call sheet when there are two people who are kind of joint leads. Like, is there ever a situation where there are two number ones, like number one A and number one B? Like, what would they list them as on the the call sheet?
This is a question.
Do they always have to go number one and number two?
I don't know. I think they possibly do.
There's always,
we need to investigate this. We will find this out for next week, because I want to know the answer to that. So next, shall we get out our tissues and look at this number one? It's Michael B. Jordan in this.
What's this?
It's a journal, so you can write to your son.
What do I write?
Tell him who you are, what you believe in, and tell him you love him.
Dear Jordan, the moment I met your mother, I knew she was the one.
He is not exactly my type.
When you try your best, but you don't succeed. And after some convincing, she fell for me too.
I think you are beautiful. When you get what you
want, but not what you... This is a journal for Jordan. Jordan, I think you should probably use your little journal and tell us what this is about.
I was born to talk about this film, quite clearly. Yeah, this is the true story of First Sergeant Charles Monroe King, as he often introduces himself, played by Michael B. Jordan, and Dana Kennedy, a New York Times journalist, played by Shantae Adams. We learn in the film's opening scenes that Dana is a single mom who was once married to Charles before he died under tragic circumstances in the Iraq War. And shortly after the film jumps back to show us how Charles and Dana met. I have to say, in excruciatingly drawn out detail.
Oh my god, yeah.
It's a 2-hour and 10-minute romance. I'll just lay
I mean,
out
why? Well. Why do you need 2 hours, 10 minutes for a romance?
It's very unnecessary. Well, I'll tell you why, because they cover basically every single interaction that these two people have over about 10 years. There's the meet cute where Charles is hanging a painting for Dana's father, who Charles served under in the military. There's the awkward first date. There's the even more awkward weekend stopover. Dana has this very deep mistrust of men because her father committed adultery when she was younger. So it takes a long time for her to trust Charles. And the film gets this across by showing us many, many dates and interactions between these two characters where not a lot happens. They're just kind of treading water and moving forward in sort of incremental amounts. So it is a little bit tough going for a lot of it, even though, you know, Michael B. Jordan and Shantae Adams are both very charismatic performers. The film sort of kicks into gear. That's probably the wrong turn of phrase, but because this is going to sound quite crass, but it sort of kicks into gear when 9/11 happens, because it's at this point that Charles sort of heads off to war, and this sort of sense of impending tragedy is really sort of amped up. And it's at this point that Dana sort of decides that she's really committed to her life with Charles, and you know that it's only going to head in one direction. So at that point, I saw it sort of picked up for me, but for the most part, I found this just very formulaic and unadventurous as a sort of film romance. You know, these two people in real life clearly went through something incredibly profound and beautiful and tragic in finding and losing each other. But the film itself just feels like it could be just any other film romance. Like, it doesn't feel special or exceptional in any way. I just felt like I'd seen so much of it done before and better elsewhere. The one caveat I will add is that by the end of this film, I was in absolute floods. Like, they really crank up the tears towards the end. Like, they really dial up the emotions, and it actually really did get me. So I thought this had a relatively strong sort of final 20-30 minutes, but until that point I was very sort of lukewarm on the whole thing. Were you similarly emotional by the end, Layla?
Yeah, it's one of those funny things where it's like, it's almost like they just have to go through the motions of sadness for me, and I will be in floods of tears over virtually anything. I've cried at many adverts for insurance companies in my time. So yeah, when the tragedy strikes and they tell you it's coming, and they tell you it's coming, they kind of even have flashes to it right in the beginning. Like, it's not like any of it's a surprise, but yeah, there's a certain there's a baby and this poor woman and they live in love, and isn't it sad what happened in the end? And I had to change my mask several times because it was just filling with tears. But I mean, it's just so slow and so uncinematic in the build up to that. Like, so much of this film is just people having phone conversations. And in a way, it's sad because they didn't get that much time together and they had a long distance relationship. So most of their relationship was film conversations. But then why is it 2 hours and 10 minutes?
I mean, that's a question for the director. And the director is Denzel Washington, right? So
I know. What's going on? I loved Fences.
Fences was a similarly glacial film, I would say, though. Like, a much better written film, but a very deliberately slow-paced film. And I just wonder if some of that has transitioned to here, where, you know, a tighter edit might have resulted in a better film.
Maybe Denzel just likes a slow film.
It's entirely possible. I think part of the problem is there's just a reverence here, or there's a commitment to telling their story as truthfully and as comprehensively as possible, I think, and not what might have worked best for the screen. There's a really sort of telling title card that pops up sort of halfway through the credits, which I don't think I've ever seen in a film before, where it explains that one of the scenes, they moved the location to a different location. There's a scene set at a cemetery, and it explains that for dramatic purposes, we changed this to Arlington National Cemetery instead of the cemetery where this character is actually buried. And it makes a big deal of the fact that they've changed this one thing, which just led me to believe, did you just change literally nothing else? Like, is everything else in this film completely truthful and honest to what happens to these people, regardless of the fact that it might not be interesting cinematically, or it might not work in a film? Like, for me, that was it just made me think, this is probably it's an honest depiction, but it could well be quite sanitized and with, you know, some of the rough edges shorn off, because these characters are depicted as quite saintly. Like, they don't do anything bad to each other. They get in such minor tiffs that they make big deals out of. And Charles in particular is just he's just an angel. Like, there's literally a painting of him as an angel, which is featured throughout the film. And I just thought, you know, if there wasn't such a close connection to the people being depicted in this film, I think, you would have shown these characters in a slightly different light. You know, no one is that perfect, but, you know, this is the film that we've got.
Yeah, it made me think a little bit of Bohemian Rhapsody. This is like clearly the people that were the subject of this are too involved and they want to make sure that they come across as well as possible in any given moment. And there were kind of hints towards it where it's like, oh, you know, we're really going to maybe have a look at kind of the strange like jingoism around the war in Iraq that happened post 9/11 and, you know, how that. And at times, Charles is a little bit, a tiny hint that there's almost like a bit of a death wish going on and kind of like the soldier's rightful place is to kind of die in with like glory and a battlefield and stuff. But actually, it skirts right past that. It's quite just like, no, this man is a literal saint. And, yeah, you know, like, I'm sure he was a wonderful guy, but it's just, it's not what I recognize as humans.
Yeah, there's one scene where she like asks him like, "Have you killed anyone?" And he just like doesn't say anything. Like he just sits there in silence, which, you know, I guess means he probably has killed someone. But the way that the film explains that is that it makes you just think it just really skirts over it. And the way that it deals with, you know, the war in Iraq is quite ham-fisted as well. Like there's a scene where the mother character, Dana, explains to her son like, "Oh, you know, some people thought we were there to like do good, and then but other people think like it was the wrong thing to do."
But it's your father was a saint, and he would have been there to defend, cared most just about defending his like soldiers under his care. I'm just like, okay, I think we've moved past that depiction of the war in Iraq of just being a lot of really well-intentioned people.
Exactly. It really both sides it in terms of what they were doing out there. And it wants to say that, you know, Charles was there for entirely noble purposes, which, you know, I didn't know the man, he may have been, but you know, it's not a very like, it doesn't feel like a very realistic depiction of what was happening at that time out there.
I mean, I haven't seen this because I couldn't get to screening, which, you know, we would have blubbed together possibly, but it sounds like a real disappointment and a sort of a frittering away of the talent of having Denzel and Michael B. Jordan working on something creative together, but they've doggedly followed the blueprint set out by the people who actually were in this film. And there's missed opportunities here. It's such a shame. I'm very sad to hear this. I kind of had high hopes for this because I think Michael B. Jordan is a really interesting actor and producer and makes some really, you know, great choices. This doesn't sound like it was one of them.
No, I think Jordan really is onto something, that it's the script that's letting it down for the most part, because actually the sex scenes where they're not talking, better.
Okay, so yeah, I mean, go for the sex scenes, and you also get some Michael B. Jordan bum on here.
Yep, he's been bigging this up, and I can see why, because he's got a very nice bum, I'll say that.
Yeah, wouldn't want to fight him.
Okay. Definitely not.
So if you fancy a bit of a weep and also some sex scenes and what sounds like a very slow romance, this is A Journal for Jordan, and it's out in cinemas on Friday. Right, it's time for alternative line reading. And as always, there is a link to something else we've talked about this week. So I'm just going to do this in my own accent and my own voice, because I kind of am with this person who says this. "I'm of an age where I know what I like and what I do not like. What I like, I enjoy enormously. What I dislike, I cannot abide." Who said that?
I know that it's wrong, but it does actually sound like a really famous Kim Cattrall meme where she says that she can't bear to be doing anything that she doesn't like, even for a second.
Which includes making the Sex and the City sequel or the TV show, which I can totally understand. No, it isn't Kim Cattrall. You should probably do it in a Belgian accent.
Oh, is it Poirot? Okay.
Yeah. Yeah,
it is Kenneth Branagh's.
That was a giveaway. That was a gimme, that one.
Yeah.
Can you do it in a Belgian accent?
Probably not.
Can you do it in a Kenneth Branagh Belgian accent?
Well, oh, yeah. I need a very, very large moustache, and to do it, I am of the age where I know what I like. You know, like he's very...
That's better than his. That's better than his. You need it to be worse.
I'm sorry, Belgian. Really sorry. Everyone in Belgium.
I have to say, I'm so excited to see that moustache back on screen in a few weeks in Death on the Nile.
Yes, we will be seeing screens I just can't wait.
Yeah, there is some accents in that trailer. I actually think Kenneth Branagh might be the least of their worries.
Accents, well, yes. The movie.
Especially with other people in that cast.
There's
anyway,
a line delivery of enough, I think Gal Gadot said something like, enough champagne to fill the Nile, which is just so like an AI that is trying to like
enough all of champagne, the like,
yeah, all
Nile.
Of the like stress is on the weirdest parts. I've watched it maybe 50,000 times because I can't wrap my head around it.
I love an Agatha Christie, and this is my favorite Agatha Christie book. So I'm really, really looking forward to it. But yes, we shall see. Has Kenneth done a better job with this than with Belfast? We will see. And this is what it sounds like when he does it, whilst eating a delicious cake.
I am of an age where I know what I like and what I do not like. What I like or enjoy enormously. What I dislike, I cannot abide.
It's time for our final film now, and I have in my hand a piece of paper with the title of this movie on it. It's this.
I believe the name Paul von Hartmann is known to you.
Yes, sir. We were at Oxford together.
He has a document in his possession. We'd like you to go to Munich tomorrow and get the document.
It'll be an act of espionage on foreign soil.
This is Munich, the edge of war. Tell us about it, Layla.
So this is set mostly in 1938, where World War II is just around the corner. And it's telling the story that I studied, I think, basically nothing but this throughout all of my GCSE history, about the causes of the Second World War and whether Neville Chamberlain's policy of appeasement was a good idea or not. It's kind of done as a bit of a thriller going up towards like Neville Chamberlain with this agreement that he has with Hitler that they essentially won't attack the rest of Europe, as we all know that they did. And it's told from the point of view of a civil servant called Hugh, who's played by George MacKay, and his friend who is working for the German government called Paul, who's played by, I'm going to pronounce this incorrectly, Yanis Nieuwenhuyzen. Apologies to him, I've probably gotten that wrong. Yeah, so it's kind of told from the point of view of mostly of these sort of two younger, lower down people in the government as they're trying to avoid a kind of impending disaster. And Jeremy Irons is actually very good, I think, as Neville Chamberlain, as kind of somebody that maybe has a few more tricks up his sleeve than everyone is giving him credit for. I quite enjoyed it. I think this is going to sound like I'm bragging, but I think I knew too much about this for to actually get any suspense out of it. Like genuinely, I went into Marie Antoinette and was just like, what ended up happening to Marie Antoinette? And I can like enjoy that because I just studied this to death during my GCSEs. I was like, yeah, no, I know. And then this is going to happen. And yeah, sure. And this, and then, you know, it, and so actually a lot of the wins was kind of taken out of the sails for me. But, you know, solid performances all around, and it's very like competently put together.
Yeah, solid isn't a glowing endorsement. Jordan, do you like it more than solid?
No, I actually think solid is a pretty fair description of this. It's not going to blow your socks off, but what I did like about it was I thought it actually weaved the sort of fictional story, this almost spy story between Paul and Hugh, these young political aides, into the historical backdrop. Like I thought it weaved those two elements together quite elegantly, actually. Like I thought they fit together really well. I really liked the fact that Hitler is a character in this film. Chamberlain is a character in this film. You get this huge political backdrop, but then you also get this quite like personal story between Paul and Hugh. You know, they're university friends who went their separate ways after school. There's sort of a third friend who is a big part of the start and becomes an important character later on, even though she isn't actually present. And I really like actually what it does with Chamberlain's character in this film, because you know, anyone who grew up in the UK will have learned that the Munich Agreement wasn't a good idea. They probably thought that Chamberlain was very short-sighted and stupid to sign it. But I kind of like that this film sort of rehabilitates him a bit and kind of puts it into a bit more context and says, oh, the British public wasn't ready for war at that time. You know, maybe signing the Munich Agreement was a kind of strategic act that sort of saved Britain a bit and bought them time to prepare for war with Hitler. Like I kind of like the idea that it's sort of saying this, and you know, there is some historical grounding for this as well. You know, Robert Harris, who wrote the book, like I think he went back to a lot of political papers and correspondence and things like that. So it's not just all pure nonsense. Like, I think there is a legitimate historical reading in all this. And Jeremy Irons portrays him very sort of sympathetically, and he has another terrific mustache, which was actually his own, as opposed to, I don't think Kenneth Branagh actually grows that mustache himself, does he?
Could do you think he doesn't? Mustache?
I mean, it must take him like 2 years to grow that mustache if he does grow it in real life. But, you know, the Chamberlain mustache in Munich at the Edge of the War, that's 100% Jeremy Irons.
And you know this because you were on set of this, weren't you? Virtually.
I was on set. I was virtually on set, yeah. So I attended this set as a Zoom call. I really liked Ulrich Mathis in this film, actually, who plays Hitler. The interesting thing about him as well is not only did he play Goebbels in Downfall, the other very famous Hitler movie, but he actually signed on to this film and was playing Hitler with 48 hours notice. It was originally Martin Wuttke, the same actor who plays Hitler in Inglourious Basterds, funnily enough. But he actually contracted COVID and had to leave the production. So Ulrich Mathis was hired, and he's terrific. This is a weird thing to say, but he's one of my favorite on-screen Hitlers because he's very like, he just looks very like, I don't know, very like weedy and just very like you can almost see the small man kind of behind his eyes and just the anger and the rage, which I think just sums up what I think of Hitler. And there's a sort of great imagined scene where Chamberlain and Hitler have this meeting, and it's just full of like tension, and you know, the historical what if of it is actually, I thought, was quite enticing and exciting, even though I totally agree with Layla, like knowing the history of this so well and what happens, like it does definitely take all of the sort of tension out of the sort of spy story side of it, where you're thinking, are they going to get this information to Chamberlain in time? Like, is he not going to sign the Munich Agreement? Like, everyone knows he does. So there's this sort of no tension there. But where the intrigue comes in is sort of what it does with the Chamberlain character and a sort of reassessment of why he signed this agreement and what it meant for Britain during the war.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'm the same as you guys. I knew about this because of having to revise it. Do you remember like writing it down and putting your highlighter through of like what happened? But I think I liked it a bit more than you. I would say it was a bit more than solid, because precisely for the reasons you've said, that the idea that Chamberlain was actually sort of playing a game of poker here. You know, he said you never play poker unless you have some cards up your sleeves. And it feels like I hadn't thought of that maybe Chamberlain was playing a different game than what the one that was reported and the one that we revised, that he was this fool that turned out of a, you know, holding this silly piece of paper on a tarmac going, look at this, I've done this, that actually maybe he was stalling for time and maybe there was a lot more thought that went into it. But I also liked that the sort of depiction of the UK and also of Germany on the brink of war, like what it was like to be in Munich at this time when tensions were high and it felt pregnant with this idea of something was going to happen, and the same in the UK. So I really liked the sort of interaction between the two sort of aides on different sides of this effort and how they were experiencing walking through those worlds and what it was like to just, you know, say being sent to Munich the next day at this time when it was just a powder keg and what was going to happen, and that the lives of everyone in Munich was going on as they would, but that you're watching this film going, that's going to end very, very soon. And what we're seeing in the UK, that's going to end very, very soon. We know what's going to come. So I enjoyed that aspect of it. I also enjoy, obviously, Jordan, that you had a Zoom call with Hitler.
That was extraordinarily surreal. Yeah.
Was he wearing his hat? Entire thing? Yeah, the whole shebang?
Literally. In full costume, yeah, that was very odd. It was me and there was a German journalist who attended this virtual conference as well. So he did one interview in German, which I sort of sat in on, which made it just even more weird that I didn't know what they were saying. They could have been talking about anything. But no, he was quite lovely. He's quite nice. Yeah. Very
interesting. It must have been even weirder.
Yeah, exactly. It was very strange. But he was, you know, playing Hitler is like, I just can't imagine what that must be like for an actor, just like having to inhabit a monster, you know, someone like that. That must weigh just very heavily on anyone who has to do that. And I think he said after he played Goebbels in Downfall, he was like, I'm never going to play a Nazi again. But I think he has quite a close relationship with the director and he really trusts him. So he did it for him, basically. And he's terrific. This film also has a very interesting supporting cast of sort of great European actors who haven't sort of had their English language breakthrough yet, like Sandra Hüller's in this, who, you know, is a terrific actress, and August Diehl as well. And both of them are a bit underserved by this film, I have to say. But you should go and check out their filmographies if you're intrigued to see what they've done in the past, because they're both terrific.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Sandra Hüller, just so amazing in absolutely everything. Yeah, no, when she had popped up on screen, I kind of did perk up, but you did, it doesn't really go anywhere that kind of serves like the great performance we've seen from her, and like Tony Erdmann, and even recently, and she was in a fantastic film called I'm Your Man, where she kind of plays a robotic dating assistant. But you know,
what a film that is.
I suppose that's the difficulty of being a German actor, like as opposed to most other people, you really have to decide what your position on playing Nazis is, because English language roles that must come up, like,
yeah. You know. Yeah, so you're saying that when you become an actor in Germany, you have to think, will I play Hitler? Would I? You have to think about that.
If you have like a certain look about you, definitely. I will say I really liked Janis Nyhoner, however we're pronouncing his surname. I'm sorry, Janis, if that's wrong. I haven't seen him in anything before, and I thought he was just really charismatic. I actually thought he sort of slightly outplayed George Mackay in this. Like, I just thought he was the more interesting.
Didn't you think that, though, because he had a better haircut? George Mackay had that quite alarming. Yeah. Sort of centre parting and the weird flip. And I felt like, you know, his German counterpart had a much more suave side parting, and it was working for him much better.
He definitely does. Yeah.
It is unfortunate because this is basically set the same time as Nightmare Alley, and everyone in that has fantastic hair. And poor George Mackay, really short end of the stick.
Yeah, because his character is just a bit more muted. Like, he's just sort of along for the ride a little bit. Like, he never feels like he's acting on anything. Whereas Paul, he's really the driving force behind the whole story. Like, he's the one who has identified the fact that Hitler is this absolute monster. Like, the world doesn't know about concentration camps yet. It doesn't know about all these awful things that Hitler is doing, and he is trying to get that message out there. And I thought that was, you know, you're really behind him. Like, you really want him to succeed in what he's doing, despite the fact he's so close to Hitler's inner circle, and you know, one slip up, that's it, he's gone.
Yeah, he has a terrifying dinner scene,
yeah,
which you wouldn't want to be in that situation, would you?
I actually saw this film last year, so that and Spencer were sort of my top two dinner scenes of the year. Just both of them very good for very different reasons. But yeah, I would say keep an eye out for Janis, because I was very impressed with what he did here, actually.
Mm. So this is available on Netflix. It's a decent film to watch on Netflix, right? I mean, you know, you're saying solid, so maybe you wouldn't want to go and spend your money at the cinema for it, but you can see it on Netflix on Friday. That's a good deal, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's a week of sort of quite poorly paced films, and I will add that this film is also quite long and takes absolutely ages to get to Munich. Like, I think it takes about an hour before you're even in Munich, which is madness. But the fact that you can pause it on Netflix and go make a cup of tea after half an hour while you're a bit bored will probably work in its favor.
Indeed. Okay, for that glowing review there, Munich the Edge of War hits Netflix on Friday. You can pause it and make a cup of tea when you're bored, says Jordan Farley. Mm.
You'll be gripped once you get to Munich.
Once you get to Munich. But, you know, it took a while to get to Munich. There was no, you know, you couldn't just hop on a plane or go on the Eurostar.
It was an ordeal back then.
There's a reason.
Munich is the Kate Blanchett of this film. It just takes a while to turn up, but it's well worth it.
Yes, indeed. Okay, so what's your film of the week, guys? Which one would you be saying get thee to the cinema to see?
Nightmare Alley, not even close.
Jordan?
Yeah, it's probably Nightmare Alley for me as well. Sadly, I wish I could have picked A Journal for Jordan, but my namesake just hasn't done it for me, unfortunately.
No, I'm in agreement. Nightmare Alley is the one that's going to be a good meaty watch. But if you love Chitty Chitty Bang Bang like I do, then Belfast does have an element of that in it, which is quite nice. All right. Well, if you want to get on board with the Total Film train, we've got a special listener offer. It's 3 issues. For £3. I mean, amazing. If you want to go to www.magazinesdirect.com/insidepod, you can select your preferred subscription package. And that means you get a magazine delivered to your door, you never miss an issue, and you pay less than you would in the shops. So it's a win-win. But before we go, there is time for a reader's question. Are you ready, guys? Here's what we've been asked this week. What's the best film set on a plane? Jordan.
Oh, that's a good question. Can I give two answers?
Yes, you may.
Because they tackle this question in a slightly different way. So my favorite film involving planes, or fighter jets more accurately, is Top Gun. Just what needs to be said about Top Gun? It's just brilliant. And then I guess my film pretty much set entirely on a plane, I'm going to go with Red Eye, the Wes Craven film from quite a few years back now, 2005, with a very delicious villainous turn by Cillian Murphy. That's a really good film. A little underseen. I would advise people to check that out. Also 86 minutes long. So in and out. Good fun. Don't miss it.
Okay. Layla, you got a treat on a plane for us?
Yeah, I was thinking about this for ages because Jordan kindly had me interview Aaron Sorkin about meeting the Ricardos. And I find I Love Lucy so incredibly unfunny. And I think comedy is one of those weird things where just stuff becomes less funny as time goes by. Although I did quite like Meet the Ricardos. So yeah, two films that are set on planes that completely defy those conventions are Aeroplane and Dr. Strangelove for me. I think they are just as funny today as they ever were. I know technically not all of Dr. Strangelove is on a plane, but there is, I think, enough plane stuff for it to warrant this question. And I think Airplane is so funny that it only recently have I realized that it was actually spoofing something, and that like kind of airplane thrillers were a thing. Like, you don't even need to know the thing that it's parodying in order for it to be absolutely hilarious. So yeah, Airplane.
Excellent. Yes, I'm going to throw out Shadow in the Cloud, which was very little seen. It was a film that I really loved at TIFF, and it feels like many moons ago now, but it's all set in a bomber in World War II, and it's, you know, just ridiculous. It's about gremlins, like real monstrous gremlins climbing on the wings, and Chloe Grace Moretz having to deal with misogyny and gremlins. It's stupid. I love it. It's so good. And I wish more people had seen it. So that's my one. That's actually on Prime Video right now. So you can watch it and enjoy it. And it's pretty nippy running time. And yeah, I loved it. It's really, really good. It was the one that I was very surprised didn't make more of a splash and when it came out of the festival. So that's it for this week, you guys. I'll be seeing you virtually in Sundance when we wait in the lobby virtually. Woo-hoo! In our moon boots. Will you be wearing a puffer or anything just to get the feel of it?
Yeah, bubble hat and gloves. Why not hand warmers? It's pretty pretty chilly in the
it's
UK
a bit
right
chilly
now.
Right now. We can make this work. I will see you.
Just leave your back
lobby.
Door open.
Leave your back door open. Wear a puffer jacket and your moon boots and all good. I might leave my freezer open just to really get the feel.
Just start a little queue outside.
Yeah. Yeah, make sure you queue to get into your lounge to watch your films. And grab really, you know, unhealthy snacks as well. Don't eat a proper meal all week, okay? That's how you do festivals. Okay, so on that note, we will say goodbye. Say goodbye, Layla.
Bye.
Say goodbye, Jordan.
Bye.
Bye from me. See you next week.
Can you fly this plane and land it?
Surely you can't be serious.
I am serious. And don't call me Shirley.